On Friday, September 28th, the Norris Group proudly presented its 11th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, tech disruption, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event would not have been possible without the generous support of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Think Realty, Wilson Investment Properties, Coach Fullerton, First Lending Solutions, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, MVT Productions, and Realty 411. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and see Amazon Prime or YouTube for past events.
I want to ask Sean one more question, and then we'll invite all the other panelists to come back and we'll bat it around for another half hour. Are other countries ahead of the United States in some of these technologies of Hyperloop or whatever, and does it matter?
I mean, like, if you follow Hyperloop, right, the projects for the companies that are U.S. companies that are building this, right, when you look at the initial places that are interested in it, it's Dubai.
Right.
And, you know, Japan has some very fast trains without even getting into Hyperloop. So, you know, when it comes to fast public transportation, we certainly have not been doing it well here in California yet. I think there, in terms of technological innovation, a lot of that is still here. However, you know, I do think you're seeing a lot more investment worldwide. You know, I have overseas software developers. And, you know, at first it was a cost thing, but there's now places in the world where you're going to get kids who started writing software, in elementary school, and by the time they've graduated high school, they've got more software coding experience than our college graduates, and by the time they're out of college, you know, they're getting far ahead. There really are a lot of countries making a lot more investment in internet and 5G.
5G.
You know, things like that. Those things are happening, and I think, you know, we can't rest on our laurels.
What's the penalty for not being first in that world?
You know, you look at something like 5G, which is, you know, the next thing after 4G. I think everybody knows 4G, cellular phones, right?
I wouldn't assume that. You're talking to one of them. Oh, yeah, 5G is just one 5G. More than 4G.
So, you know, but you're a 4K movie, right? You think about how long that takes to download today, right? You're talking about downloading a 4K movie in a few seconds. And it's not really just about, oh, I got my movie faster, right? Now, if you can download, you know, 2 hours of a movie in a couple of minutes or whatever, you can now have streaming real-time 4K. Add that to AI, right? You can be interacting with things that look virtually real, right?
Right.
You talk here about virtual reality, but now it can be mobile, right? So you could be inside of a moving vehicle that is projecting different things in front of you in real time. If it's augmented reality, where it doesn't completely block your eyes, but you still see the outside world, imagine driving down the streets. And unfortunately, where this is probably going to happen first is advertising, right? You're going to drive down the street, and a big arrow is going to jump out in front of you in your car display going, you know, eat here. And then, you know, a clown's going to jump up over here. And, like, we're going to have, like, full real-time, like, advertising jumping out of
But it'll be safe because we won't be driving our cars.
We won't be driving anyways. It won't matter.
I will say this, though, Bruce, to answer the question. I know I'm not the technology guy here, I would say that not being first or a leader in technological development in the near future will have national security implications.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the position that the United States government and our country has right now in terms of leadership will be challenged if we don't continue to lead the world in that regard, which is why I'll give my pitch for immigration reform. I think the worst thing we can do, the dumbest thing we can do, is have people come to this country, get educated from our institutions, and then send them out of this country. Intelligence, skill, education, educated young people are the biggest asset and resource we have in this country right now. We got to keep them here.
Yeah, good question.
You guys, come on up, please, and join us. I'm going to try to cover what I've heard concerns of. You know, when I speak, obviously one of them, sales of homes. So all the flippers have talked to me about sales slowing, and I've even had meetings at the office. So let's talk about the sales. Sales are down. So what is our opinion of why that is? Anybody?
Affordability? Costs, interest rates, affordability in general.
Okay. Historically, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to be an argumentative, but
no.
Our affordability where it is in California right now, let's say 26, our volume of sales usually is exploding until we get to 17. It's higher at 26 than it is at 30, higher at 20 than it is at 26, because there's been momentum and all that. So, you know, 26, unless, and we've talked about this to you guys, maybe because of lending restrictions, 26 is the new 17. Remember, maybe we're really butting up against that ceiling earlier than we ever have because people can't really qualify, okay?
We survey 1,000 households a month, and the survey is targeted toward the next 12 months, and we produce something called the Home Purchase Sentiment Index. That has flattened off and, in fact, tipped down just a little bit. We looked at two questions in particular 2 months ago. One is, is it a good time to buy a house? Of those who said it's not a good time to buy a house, for the first time that we've done this survey since 2010, the number one reason was house price. On the question of is it a good time to sell a house, for those who said it's a good time to sell a house, the number one reason was house price.
Okay.
So we, in last month's press release, we said we believe that means a plateau in home sales. So the most recent month, both those numbers strengthened. And we concluded that, yes, it's a good time to sell a house if you have a lot of equity in it, because you'll have a lot of equity in it. But if you have to buy another one, you're just going to give it away to that other person. So we've clearly seen, at the national level, a topping of the market.
And I just wanted to add, one thing you have to remember about that index is that index isn't based on affordability based on all available loan products. It assumes a 30-year mortgage.
20%
down. When it hit a 17, right, we had pay option arms. So I would actually say that at the 17, we had much higher affordability in terms of what somebody, average person walking off the street, could buy and afford than we have today.
Well, it hit 17 in 80, 89, and 05. It hit 11 in the
11,
nonsense.
Right?
Yeah. So that's kind of why I buy into 17 being a somewhat legitimate number instead of 11. I wouldn't think we're going to go there either. Priority of owning a home. You know, John, you've covered, you know, you've broken down the generations in a different way. Has home ownership regained some of its strength of, like, people really want it, or is it
All the surveys I've read is that the desire to own a home has never waned really this whole time. The economy hit the people born. We broke the generations down by the decade you were born, so that's how I'll talk about it. But the people who were born in the 1970s got absolutely crushed during the last downturn, and that's where most of the home ownership fell. They had the highest home ownership rate ever at their 10-year high school reunion, and by their 20-year high school reunion, they were 11% behind. So they're making a comeback, but there's some distaste there, and that's that move-up buyer. I think what you're asking the question on existing home sales, though, is what's different this time is that we're requiring documentation, so we can't the stupidity that happened at the end of the other cycles can't happen. And interest rates are higher, so people are not wanting to give up their fixed rate mortgage, their great fixed rate mortgage, to go get a higher fixed rate mortgage. And I think those two things, as well as the price issue, are contributing to slower sales. And that's not Armageddon or a downturn. Those are just three differences.
Bruce, I would add in there, too, I had mentioned earlier we just released our latest consumer report at Zillow, is that 42% of the buyers right now are millennials, and half of all buyers are first-time buyers right now, which is a big factor in this, right? They don't understand necessarily how it works. The affordability is a factor. There's so many pieces of the puzzle there. And so when you have these younger buyers coming up, that is, it's, and we have such a large generation. You broke it down by decade, which is great. Millennials, obviously, a lot bigger from, you know, 24 to 38 years old is a big population. But when they're first-time home buyers, that's going to naturally change the game and how it works.
Do we think there's some tailwinds for housing? What's your opinion of that? What would be some of the tailwinds that housing could experience?
If you'll give me the platform for a second, can I talk a little bit about mortgages? Because
sure.
Doug and I have spent a lot. So while I agree with everything that Gary said, I want to make sure that I have a difference in what I think the conclusion was. And Doug and I have talked about this a lot, and he's going to be speaking on it at our upcoming event. The documentation is extremely tight, but 24% of all mortgages today are FHA mortgages, which are at or near an all-time high. So while the banks aren't making them, Loan Depot is. So the FHA programs are definitely there. Dodd-Frank said you should not make a loan above 42% of somebody's, all their debts should not be above 42% of their income. But we're going to exempt Fannie, Freddie, and FHA because it's 2010 and we're in a housing crisis. We're 2018 and they're still exempt. And I think 44% of all mortgages are above that number now. So we're very high debt to income ratios. And we have the highest LTV mortgages ever. So while the documentation is tight and the banks aren't doing some of this, I do believe that the mortgage industry, which, by the way, 71% of it is controlled by presidential appointees now, when you look at FHA and FHFA overseeing Fannie and Freddie, it's not that hard to get a mortgage if you've got the documentation. If you're self-employed, maybe you don't have the documentation, but it's really not that hard.
And there is pressure to ease underwriting criteria, but if you think of the fact that demand, to your point about the millennials, demand is growing faster than supply, in that environment, if you ease credit conditions, it's pro-cyclical to price. And if, as we talked earlier, you're approaching a recession, the very people for whom you eased credit to get them on the wagon are likely to be the first people off the wagon. So you want to be really careful about whether you're not creating conditions where you're putting people who into a very highly leveraged asset at a time when there's going to be a change in asset valuations.
Yeah, Sean, you and I have talked about this to where, you know, we could have said in 2009, okay, forget it. Anybody who's breathing can get a loan because now their house would have gone up by two or three times.
Yeah, right.
We'd have solved a lot of affordability issues and everything. So we let loose of the reins late in the cycle, but we don't do it when it's most appropriate and most affordable.
Not only that, but in debating whether to attempt to halt the price declines that were underway in that, we introduced policy to prevent that, which means that prices never actually reset according to market fundamentals. So if you look at the relationship between incomes and prices, price never got back to the relation to its long-term relationship with fundamentals of income.
You know, I think, now this is just my opinion, but that's why I love to bat it around. I think there's a lot of safeguards in this market. So the fact that we have a certain percentage of FHA loans right now, what about all the loans that are in place? So, you know, for you to have a price decline going forward, you'd have to have, in my opinion, a glut of foreclosures emerge from this pile of loans that we have. I don't see how that happens. You've got the biggest bunch of trillions of dollars of equity, and we haven't refied our equity out this time. Probably not because we wouldn't have wanted to, but they didn't let us. So you have this huge pile of equity. Everyone has a fixed rate loan by and large, not a teaser rate, and there's no programs that could explode. You know, you don't have a two-year program that 2 years from now a lot of people have, and that's going to be a problem. We don't have that. We have a fixed rate loan that starts with a 3 or 4 predominantly, left the equity in place. The last 8 years, people have actually had to have down payments. They've had credit that they care about. They've had all the stuff that you qualify for. I mean, how do you end up with a gigantic pile of foreclosures out of that? And to me, that's the driver of price going down. I'd love to hear some disagreements with that. I really would.
Well, it would be massive job loss because most people are living paycheck to paycheck, and if a lot of people lose their jobs, you'll have a lot of defaults. So, but it's not anything else. It's just people need a job.
Okay, what's a lot of defaults? Because this is the ratio. Let's take a look at a median price. I'm just batting around with you. Yeah. You know what that's okay. So in the 80s. That would be called high unemployment. In the beginning of the 80s, we had 9.5%, 10% unemployment. We had 1,000% increase in foreclosures and no change to the median price. Go to the 1990s, and by the way, that was about 1 in 4 sales, if you will, trustee sales to sales. Go to the 90s, you have a ratio that got to about 40%, so 4 of 10 comps are theoretically an REO. And the latest one, 2008, it was 80%. Trustee sales to sales. So I look at that and say, the 80s we didn't have price damage, 90s we had gradual price damage and we had a catastrophe. So how do I determine what the next downturn, slowdown, crash is going to look like? I try to look at the ratio of trustee sales to sales, and that's where I'm coming from, is I don't, even though you're right, you're going to have all those charts go negative, you're going to have unemployment, you're going to have a rise in foreclosures. But if it only gets to 25% of the market, 1 in 4 comp is an REO, then the appraiser, when he goes out there, can go, that's not the market. The market is the other 3. If it's 4 of 5, they can't do that. It is the market.
I would only say this, is that, you know, real estate crashes on a national level are extremely rare.
Yes.
But they happen in local markets, right, more frequently. So I think the scenario that you described, while it might not be impact, you know, prices from a national standpoint, there's local economies that could be devastated if there's dramatic losses in jobs. And depending on where those markets are, you could see large price reductions in some of those markets. So I do think that's kind of the way it operated for decades before 2008. I think after 2008, we think again about the likelihood of another national housing crash. I think you're right, though, Bruce. The fundamentals are extremely different today than they were in the early 2000s, and a lot has to do with lending. And so to go back to your point about, you know, FHA loans are being made. They are being made by independent mortgage lenders. And as I said before, there's multiple buyers for every property that comes for sale right now. So the impact of, you know, not having enough qualified buyers hasn't really been felt. But I think it can. I think that can change as the supply and demand balance sort of changes. Also, people, independent mortgage bankers tend to be the ones that are the first ones out of the market when the market really gets soft. So if 95% of the FHA loans and first-time home buyers in general are being serviced by independent mortgage bankers right now, that's fine. But when the market does turn, a lot of those companies are going to retreat, if not get out of the business altogether. So not having the big lenders in there can have an effect down the line for sure.
They could stop lending during the next, even a little bit of a slowdown, because they just don't have the capacity to lend it. And who's going to be making those FHA loans?
That's right.
Some legislation that's going to get voted on, rent control for California. Just spoke at an apartment conference. That was very interested group. So I'm just curious, do you think it'll pass?
I've been hogging the mic. I'll let one of them do
okay. Anybody have an opinion? No?
No.
I think it's a mistake. You know, in general, I think manipulating the market like that always has unintended consequences. I kind of get it, right? I mean, we do have a rental affordability crisis, but I think you solve that by adding more supply into the marketplace, which is challenging, but I think that's the only way to get it done in the long run.
Okay.
I just say the only way you solve affordable housing is to actually build more affordable houses. You know, we've made in my little hometown of near San Luis Obispo, right? My dad hated this local builder because he just built these crappy homes with T111 siding and just terrible windows, and like everything about these homes was awful. But they were half the price of the rest of the homes. You can't legally build that home here anymore, right? You have to meet Title 24 and all this, you know, environment. So you're talking about a home that cost half as much, and yeah, maybe it costs $50 more a month to heat, but if it's half as much and it costs $50, that's a good trade-off. Like, I really think we need to bring back the ability to build some subdivisions of really homes.
Okay, I've got a.
Could be the quarter.
Well, NIMBYism. Somebody said, "Not in my backyard." And just to be clear, right? This is. We are the reason we don't have affordable homes, right? I live in Tahoe. And it's funny, we have a local nonprofit who has two missions, right? One, mountain area preservation. They want to preserve the area as it is. And their other mission is affordable housing. You know, choose, right? You're not going to get everything small town stay the way it is, not in my backyard, and get more houses and affordability. Everybody wants affordable housing if it's far, far away. And that is our fundamental, you know, problem. We've got state legislatures who maybe aren't quite as local that are trying to shove some of this down the city's throat, as we heard mentions to earlier. And cities and local, right, those local homeowners, as soon as it's a subdivision in their yard, an ADU with an Airbnb rental next door, people have a real problem with it. And that's the fundamental. We come to consensus around that. We solve affordable housing.
California, according to CARB, is maybe building 80,000 less homes than they feel like could be occupied. Is that about right, John?
I'm not sure.
Okay. What is the process like for a California builder versus any other place? Is it just?
Oh, it's just hellacious. I mean, I have national clients who build basically the same home here that they build in other markets. I mean, there's some elevation differences, and they're hundreds of thousands of dollars cheaper. I mean, the affordable housing solution is in Texas and Arizona, and that where is 62% of migration going from Arizona through Florida into Georgia? And the public builder with the best margins and the fastest growth and the best stock prices, a company named LGI Homes, their average sales price is, I think, $80,000 less than everybody else's. They just came to Rio Vista in Northern California, and I understand sold 80 homes in 30 days.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Guaranteed Rate, and Nathan Chiboya, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jason Thorman with Coldwell Banker, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keystone CPA, LA South RIA, Las Brisas Escrow, Michael Ryan and Associates, New Western, NorCal RIA, NSDREI, Orange County Real Estate Investors, The Outspoken Investor, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Real Wealth Network, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, SJREI, Spinnaker Loans, South OC RIA, Tri-County Association of Realtors. You Direct IRA Services. White House Catering. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.